South Africa, we have divergent definitions. So in the Constitution, a young person or a child is under 18 years old. In the White Paper on Social Welfare, youth are 16 to 30. Now, that's interesting that in certain pieces of our policies, we have varying definitions of youth. To vote or to get a driver's license, you need to be 18 years old. But the legal age of majority in South Africa is 21. So we've got a number of definitions and ranges of youth. But certainly for our definition in terms of the National Youth Policy, 14 to 35 is what we're looking at, and that's what I'll talk about predominantly today. What is the global reality of young people? Well, there's extended education. Young people used to go work at much younger ages, 100 years ago, 50 years ago. It often takes them longer time to find work and therefore a longer window for unemployment, longer financial and residential dependence, lots of older young men still staying at home with their mothers. Earlier first-time experiences of puberty, of sexual debut, of substance use. Postponed marriage and often disaffected about marriage. So reluctant to get married. Some things around cultural traditions. Paying lobola, for example, puts a financial burden on young men, and so marriage is postponed. There's an extended gap between puberty and marriage, and so lots of opportunity for sexual relationships outside of a single monogamous relationship. Childbearing outside of marriage, and a mismatch between global expectations and local reality. In the South African context, young people have great expectations for the future and yet find themselves in a socioeconomic environment where they cannot achieve a lot of their expectations. Now, I don't mean you to read all of those, but the legislative framework is vast, beginning with the Constitution, the Reconstruction Development Program 94, the National Youth Commission Act in 96, the White Paper for Social Welfare in 97, the Correctional Services Act and the amendment to that in 94 and 96, and you'll see why that's important in a few minutes. A lot of young people are actually in correctional facilities. The National Youth Policy in 2000, the Development Policy Framework, the White Paper on Special Needs Education. And why is that important? I'll talk about that in a few minutes. Corrections again in 2003, the Children's Act that I think somebody has addressed you on from the Children's Institute, the African Youth Charter from 2006, the Draft National Disability Policy Framework that also deals with young people, the National Youth Development Agency Act that you've had input on, and then the National Youth Policy, which is meant to drive national youth policy for the next 5 years, that was drafted and accepted early last year. So just to start off with the African Youth Charter, the charter is about 40 articles in length. I'm not sure how many of you are aware of it or have read it, but it's a drive to ensure that youth development across the continent is homogenous and caters to each country, but is driven by various principles. So Articles 2 to 9, for example, are basic human rights, freedom of association, expression, religion, those kinds of things, constitutional values. It also asks that countries articulate national youth policy, and it talks about the responsibilities of youth. A key drive in the African Youth Charter is that youth are part of their own development and need to take responsibility for their own development as well as being enabled through government policies and frameworks, creating an enabling environment for them. But there are a few really interesting articles in the African Youth Charter that I thought might be of interest to you. The Education and Skills Development article speaks about quality education, holistic the development of a free society, free basic education, no exclusion for pregnant young women, sex education across the board for young people, and education that prepares young people for work. Now, you'll see that most of these are in the National Youth Policy because we were involved in drawing up the African Youth Charter quite intimately. Poverty eradication, Article 14, and socioeconomic integration of youth, especially around rural regeneration, helping young people find meaningful employment and lives in rural communities rather than always migrating to the city. New legislation around credit, it's very difficult to be impoverished in South Africa and trying to access credit because you're penalized, because you're not a good credit risk. And so in that sense, impoverished people are penalized twice, by being impoverished and then by not being able to access financial services credit. And Social Security is another key. Health. And here again, it's just a really good lead up into the national youth policy, because health is really important, and when I talk about the youth bulge, we'll see why in a minute. Youth-friendly reproductive health services, HIV prevention, access to voluntary counseling and testing, ARVs, and food security if you're HIV positive, legislative steps to prevent unsafe abortions, tobacco control, drug trafficking. Those are all things that we hear about generally, but for young people, they are especially pertinent because it affects their livelihood and their contribution to our country. Law enforcement, to focus on social rehabilitation rather than punishment. And I think that's really important, and that's why the Correctional Services Amendments and Acts are really important. Youth and culture, to promote and protect morals and traditional values, and to eliminate traditional practices that undermine the physical integrity and dignity of women, to both embrace culture but also prepare young people for a knowledge-based economy. And that's quite a challenge, certainly in South Africa and in the continent, because too few young people have access to ICT, to information computer technology systems. If you go into a township library, there's a queue a mile long for a half an hour on a computer for internet access, for project research. But that's where the world is going in terms of a knowledge-based economy. Leisure and recreation, there's so little of it. And so a lot of young people say they have sex because that's one way of having recreation. And we need to take that seriously, that there's not enough leisure opportunities and recreational activities for young people. Give them something else to do, and they'll stay out of trouble. I sound like my mother, but, you know, it's pretty much true. and then Article 25, the elimination of harmful social and cultural practices. I just came back from Dar es Salaam a few weeks ago, and there's a notion in Swahili called mila potofu. And really what it is, it's unhelpful cultural practices. So, for example, and this is not directly related to youth, but there's a practice of widow cleansing. When a woman has lost her husband, then there's often a practice in some parts of Tanzania where the woman needs to have sex with somebody. Now, that's a huge HIV risk. That's what people in Tanzania are thankfully calling mila potofu, an unhelpful cultural practice. There are many, many, many more. And one of the things that I'm working on at the moment is trying to put together, to distill a few unhelpful cultural practices that we need to be talking about as activists and as policymakers. Not because culture is bad, culture is fantastic, but they're parts that are mila potofu. So the South African National Youth Policy focuses on six major areas. If you've read it and you know it and you're tired, I'm sorry for repeating it. But education, quality education, and currently there's a low throughput. The number of young people who begin in grade 1 and who finish in matric or grade 12 is low. Economic participation is dire. It's low. 50% of young people are unemployed. And if you think about it, does that mean that 50% of young people will never be employed in their life? It's a possibility. Health and well-being is increasing, except we have, of course, issues around fertility, maternal health and well-being, and HIV and AIDS, of course. What about social cohesion and civic participation? Do we need moral regeneration, or do we need more adult involvement in the lives of young people? That was the topic of my PhD thesis, and I won't go into all the details now. But I have a strong feeling from my work, from my empirical work, that young people know right and wrong. What they don't know is how to translate that and think about it and make decisions on the spur of the moment, because there isn't a lot of people giving them help and advice along the way. So sometimes moral regeneration can paint young people as no-hopers, as lost, as morally bankrupt, when it's not the case. What happens is that there isn't enough adult involvement in young people's lives. The fifth area that the National Youth Policy focuses on is National Youth Service, which is incredibly successful in small pockets. The one problem that people always face is that you come out of a National Youth Service program or a volunteer program or even a learnership, and there aren't exit opportunities. There's no full-time employment that you can then walk into. You come out, you're trained, and you're all dressed up with nowhere to go. So exit opportunities need to be improved. And then finally, the National Youth Policy focuses on youth work, recognizing it as a profession, and then putting in checks and balances and training, mandatory training in place. So we have an incredibly comprehensive National Youth Policy that will guide us for the next 5 years. There's also been a focus on who are the target groups. Not surprisingly, young women is on the top of that list. Youth with disabilities on the top of that list. Unemployed youth and school-aged youth who are not in school. Youth in rural areas and then youth at risk, fairly broadly defined to include young offenders, young people who are HIV positive, infected or affected with HIV, substance abusers, children or youth heading households, and those who are in danger of being abused or exploited in any way, whether it's from human trafficking or child abuse or molestation or rape. So those are the target groups of our National Youth Policy. So it's looking after the marginalized, looking at education and job opportunities, health and well-being, social cohesion, youth service, and youth work. The three concepts that I want to just talk about briefly is the concept of the youth bulge. We're at the point in human history where we've got the largest number of youth ever. And why is that? Well, young people are healthier and better educated than they've ever been in the history of the world since Adam and Eve. This is the time in our history that young people are the healthiest, and mortality rates are dropping. And when mortality rates drop and life expectancy is positive, people tend to have less children, and they rather tend to put more energy and quality into having fewer children than having a lot more children because they are afraid that children would die. So there's a huge bulge in South Africa. It's an enormous opportunity for rapid human and economic development. About 25 to 40% of the East Asian economic miracle between 1960 and 1990 are attributed to this youth bulge. Let me show you what I mean rather than letting you see some pictures. That's the youth bulge in Korea at the moment. Can you see that they don't have a large aging population, so there's not lots of money to be spent on end of life diseases or care, but most of the people in Korea are economically active young people who are healthy with few children. And so if you look further down the bulge, you'll see that there's fewer children and less hungry mouths to feed. So in Nigeria, they're not experiencing a youth bulge at the moment. They're still experiencing loads and loads of young children being born and many children to support. In South Africa, let me just find the South African picture, we are almost at the pinnacle of a youth bulge. You'll see that the bulge is between, it's about 15 to 19 and 20 to 24. And in the next 10 to 30 years, those young people will become our biggest resource if we can find them jobs. If we can't find them jobs, they could possibly become our biggest liability. Because we have all these young people with energy, they will be healthier and better educated than any other young South Africans have been in our history. And what will we do with them? In South Korea and in Southeast Asia, they were put to work, and the economy of Southeast Asia grew hugely. The East Asian tiger, we've all heard of that. It was because of the youth bulge. So what the youth bulge comes at a cost. And I want to just read some of the notes that I've made here. We've got to drive down fertility so that we don't just have more mouths to feed, but we allow these young people to become involved in the economy and with fewer children to look after and to support. We have to protect the health of young people. One of our biggest caveats is that our working age population between 25 and 35 are dying from HIV and AIDS. We've got to scale up treatment and prevention. We've got to increase the quality and the quantity of education to train young people to participate in a knowledge-based economy, not just to sell fruit and vegetables on the side of the road, but to participate in a knowledge-based economy. They need to be productively engaged in work, and we need to increase the number of women, young women, entering the market. The bulge doesn't last forever, and what happens to that bulge is they become what is happening in most of Europe. The pyramid is like this. There's an enormous number of old people that need to be supported. If we don't have a bulge that has created capital and increased pension funds and social security and the tax base, we're just going to have a lot of old people with no funding to support them. So why is this youth bulge important? Three reasons. It shifts the conceptualization of young people from a drag on economic growth to being at the heart of development. And that's really important and probably one of the most important points I want to make. So instead of viewing young people as problems that need fixing and a drain on resources, they can be seen as an opportunity for development. Secondly, it adds urgency to the need for investment. We can't wait. In the next 10 to 30 years, we could be reaping the reward of our youth bulge, or we could be setting ourselves up for failure in 30 or 40 years' time with this huge number of old people without a tax base, a pension base to support them. And thirdly, instead of just saying that young people are the future, it provides a scientific argument for investment in young people. And that's why the youth bulge is important and something that I think needs to become part of our conversation at every level of policymaking and practice. But our youth development is lagging. We still have a high pregnancy rate for young women, and most of which are unplanned. We have HIV rates that are tailoring off for teenagers but increasing for the 19 to 45-year-old age group. We have 180,000 young men in prison. Only 29% of young people who leave school each year have got a matric. We've got poor maths and science scores. We know that. We've got a 50% unemployment rate. And we don't have many young people engaged in civic life. And that needs to change and to increase. The other two concepts that I want to talk about very briefly is first chances. First chances is basically what we do at the ground level to get things right. And they're pretty simple. We make sure that we have early childhood development, ECD. The more that we help children, we find problems with children when they're young, the easier it will be to help them when they're older. So, for example, 22% of South African children have got some kind of special needs that aren't being addressed in schools because we don't have a comprehensive special needs program in our schools. When you have a special need and you're sitting in school and teachers teach and your peers play or work, what happens is you've become frustrated. What happens when frustration festers? You become aggressive. Who are the kids who are probably getting involved in social banditry, criminal activity, aggression at school? It's the kids who had early needs as a child that weren't taken care of. 22% of our children have the potential to become problems in high school and to take knives to school and guns to school and be involved in violence. So we want to keep children in school as long as possible. We want to expand early childhood development and foundation phases. We want to help them, we want to strengthen families to provide support and care and to build social networks. Now that's the ideal. But of course there's second chances. And that's the other notion that I think we must talk about. We need to talk about how we can adequately resource second chances policies for young people who've dropped out, who are in prison, who have had a child and now want to come back into the education system. And I'm talking about young men and young women. My last piece of research that I finished a few months ago is called Teenage Tata. It's about young fathers in some of the townships and informal settlements in South Africa. and I'm going to leave a copy with the Honourable Chairperson. And I'm sure that there will be a distribution of some of the research amongst Portfolio Committee, because I know we have a statutory obligation to do that. But young fathers are often seen as just being irresponsible, denying paternity, running away. In my study, basically, there was a whole lot of issues that came up, and that was that these young men, many of these young men, drop out of school in order to get work and then can't get back into the schooling system, because once you started earning money, the child doesn't stop costing anything. It just continues to cost things. But also, young men have problems, psychosocial problems, accessing and trying to discuss and have negotiations with family members. Those are important things that we need to help young men. And generally, when we talk about fertility, we only tend to have policies and programs for young women. Adolescent reproductive health services are almost inaccessible to young men. The young men in my study said, I don't want to go because I'm afraid that they'll shout at me. Now, if you're already a young father, shouting should be the least of your worries. But that's what young men feel, that they don't want to go and access reproductive health services because of the fear of nurses, who I suppose are quite scary to a 15-year-old young man who's had a child. So second chances need to be linked to mainstream pathways, restorative, not punitive. And at the moment, they're small-scale, fragmented, and under-resourced, underutilized, and young people feel like rejects rather than as young people who need second chances, not just to be dumped aside. I've spoken about what still needs attention. I think special needs education, because it will help us with our problems of crime and violence amongst young men especially. Rehabilitation for young offenders. Substance use rehabilitation is enormous, and it's not accessible to the average kid who lives in Langa or Khayelitsha or Orlando. It's not accessible, mental health services in their communities. Their recreational opportunities are low. Media. The media diet that young people are fed is dismal. And whatever the research sometimes is conflicted, but more and more the research is finding that violent movies and violent games encourages violence in children. We don't have any kind of legislation or control for children in what they're allowed to access, especially given the fact that so many adults are absent from children's lives. Mothers are frequently out working, and fathers in the South African context are frequently absent. So who watches over what young people watch? The truth is, nobody. I'm not saying I'm all for an open society, but I think an open society it starts when you're able to make adult decisions. When you're 15 or 16, you don't always know what's best for you. And so in that sense, I'm a little bit conservative. And young fathers, ready to step up and take responsibility, but have very little access to services. HIV, there's been an improvement amongst teenagers, but we can't take our foot off the gas. Last example. You can see that the teenage rate of HIV prevalence, the middle one, is going down. But just above that, adults described as the kind of 19 to 45-year-olds, that's going up. And here's the more scary statistic. Intergenerational sex is increasing. Older men, younger women. And four important pieces from our recent HSRC study. So 90% of youth reported exposure to one or more AIDS prevention programs. That's a good thing. But HIV prevention knowledge has declined generally amongst adults. It was 64% in 2005. It's 44% in 2008. The increase in men and women having multiple partners has gone up, nearly doubled in 6 years. Young men and young women, although much higher, almost 10% for young men, and now that's changed to 20%, young women from 2% to 4%. And the increase in use of condoms has gone up, which is a good thing. But why has knowledge gone down if young people report exposure? We might be having AIDS fatigue, AIDS information fatigue. Why is our message about condoms getting through, but not our message getting through about multiple partners? So that's just one example, and I think I could probably give you a few more. But we can't take our foot off the petrol in any of these areas, whether it's education, whether it's HIV, and whether it's job creation, whether it's health and well-being. we need to keep our foot on the gas in so many areas, which is a difficult task. I think our youth policy helps us to do that, and those concepts of first chances, second chances, and harnessing the potential of the youth bulge will also help us to do that. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Swart. I'd like to apologize for our chairperson, because she's sick. But we told her to drink water for a few minutes and just a bit of honey, and then she'll take over again. And we'd like to thank you, Dr. Swart, because these are things, you know, when it comes to youth development that we do not think about. And it's good to have stakeholders, you know, that can inform us about things that we should know, because I don't think we knew about the youth bulge, and you know, and the way it works, and you know, and what will happen in South Africa as we go along, because people are saying at the moment, will we have enough money to support the older persons, you know, in life? And a person can also see, you know, how do societal factors, even legislation, influence you. But I think you gave us hope, because it's a responsibility by looking at that first and second chances too. Thanks a lot for that, Dr. Swart. Are there any questions? You can question.
Thank you, Chairperson. I came in a bit late. I apologize for that. I actually want just to mention or maybe ask a viewpoint from Dr. Swart. When we say that children are on their own without parents, I think the other problem that I have is with the programs on our TVs and also the internet, because we must remember that our children are so good. They are excellent with IT. I mean, us as parents will take years to get where they are. The cell phones and all of it. So I think that it is not just, saying that it is maybe the parents. And I understand and I do have respect for what you're saying, because I also believe that. If parents can be with their children, then it would be good. But under circumstances in many people's lives, it's impossible. So I think that the rest of it needs to play along with it. So I think that us as a committee, we will also have to go look at if I scroll through the DSTV, what do you get? Nothing uplifting, nothing really than these animation movies that we watch, not even the six-year-olds really watch that anymore. And then maybe also to add that altogether, I think in all of what we discuss around these targeted groups, like women, youth, children, and persons with disability. I also think that it is important that we look at the family. I think that the breakdown of the family, and maybe this is a bit longer, but I think you may be the person to speak to. Family life is we're struggling to get that binded and really to the essence of a family, the closeness of a family. And very often because of, again, conditions, it makes it impossible. But I think that maybe some support or maybe we need to think and debate what are we going to do there. There is a family policy, and I don't think that that family policy is getting enough attention right now. So for now, I'll just add that.
I'm going to go out on a little limb about television, for example. I think our public broadcaster is trying to do a really good job at combining education and entertainment. I think that ETV is abysmal. If I watch ETV for research purposes, I find wrestling, I find soft porn, and I find lots and lots and lots of violent B-grade movies that I wouldn't even go and get myself out of a video store. It's poor programming, and it lacks imagination and creativity. Now, I'd love to take that on at some point, but maybe it's something a portfolio committee takes on in some way. The other thing is that there are two families in our country, two kinds of families. There are families who are middle class with resources, and yeah, parents work hard, but they're present. Then there are families where parents are really absent, either through death or illness, but also just through being working shifts and working hours. And I think we mustn't forget that as policymakers, that there are two worlds. And the one family can police the internet and have internet and can police the DSTV. The other family, you know, come home exhausted from working 12-hour days, go to bed, and the kids stay up and watch TV and get fed the kind of garbage that I think that I've been referring to. And I don't want to sound like a conservative, because I don't believe in complete censorship. I just think that parents need help in restricting and limiting diets of children to media. And I think that the broadcasters need to be responsible in what they're putting on.
Thanks a lot. Just one question, let me close in this discussion. Your question, Honourable Member? Yes, only one. And we close in, because we've got another presenter.
Maybe let me not raise it as questions. Let me just tabulate issues. Yeah, because to tabulate, I want to tabulate triple BEE in connection with children. Tabulate also gambling. Just today we were discussing the gambling, you know. And then also tabulate, we talk of street children or children born and working in the streets. We should also consider youth growing up and, you know, in the streets, you know, because it's those children that graduate into youth. And then maybe we must also consider community children, you know, where we try to say, shouldn't we have community children? And then let's also consider cooperatives, because when measures of economic growth are just enriching a few, then we leave the bulk of the parents outside the economic growth. And then we must explore if cooperatives should not be encouraged amongst the youth so that they also learn a spirit of working together. Thanks.
Thanks for that. And I'm just giving over quickly to Mrs. Robertson, and then we'll just stop there. Because I think you were short and his recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, I take what you say so seriously. And I think a lot of this, for example, street children and so on, things like that come into local government. But perhaps we should strengthen the arm of local government. We certainly have street people agencies that I know of that I'm involved with. But just recently from a trip to the UK, I saw how much the local governments, again, are putting in programs for families, like community centres where you can do all sorts of things, swimming, sport, various other types of things. And I think that would be useful too. And if we can encourage mentorships where you can have partnering, these projects where you have a granny in one community who doesn't have a grandchild looking after another one, or students who are going to be mentoring studies, I don't think that there's any way we can legislate that, but perhaps we can try and create an enabling environment for people to create structures that will help. It's going to take a lot of hard work, but I think there is hope if we make a start at least.
People are just very able and capable. They need a little bit of help, whether it's legislative or activist or NGO. They just need a catalyst because they really are not the no-hopers that often the media makes them out to be. So thank you again.
We're going to stop with this discussion now. But what is your stance as the HSRC regarding the decriminalisation of prostitution in our country towards 2010? I could think on your answer, but I'd like to hear the stance.
Oh, my word.
Not a personal stance, not your personal stance, because I know what your personal one will be, but the one of the organisation.
I don't think we have one. But that's a very interesting question. There's always two sides of the story. You need to protect the young women who find that the only way to make a living, need to protect them in some way. And that would be the argument, you know, for decriminalizing. On the other hand, why would you want to encourage risky sexual activity? So those are, and I, you know, I see both. I actually don't, I'm quite torn. And I think both need to be, you almost need to do both at the same time. Protect the young women who are forced into that situation and yet make it really hard for, especially men, to access services.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Swartz. But I think we still need more dialogue, you know, with this institution of ours, the Human Science Research Council, because we can learn a lot from you. And when it comes to this aspect, I think we'll call you in again too. Yes, think about the doctor, because it's a topical issue at the moment, and it's high on the agenda. And I think even the recommendations that were made earlier on too, you know, those are things we think about. The next speaker, or the presenter, is from the South African Disability Alliance. And you may start your presentation, sir. It's, the surname is, I think it's Katoni, eh? Okay.
Thank
Katoni.
You. Thank you, Chair. My name is Mzolisi Katoni.
Katoni, yeah.
Tony is my surname. I would want to thank the Portfolio Committee for allowing us to have this opportunity to share some of our thinking around its work and what we think it's supposed to do in support of advancing the development of disabled people in South Africa. I don't think that I'm going to be long on my presentation because my understanding is just to highlight key issues that I think are pertinent for consideration by this committee. Other than that, we have we are excited by the new developments with regards to the consolidation of the ministry with regards to women, youth, children, and people with disabilities. And that we have actually, in that regard, met with the minister, and we are hopeful that things will be better than before. But however, we would want to highlight the need for us to increase the momentum in elevating issues around disability, because all of the things have been done. We have met with the Office on the Status of Disabled Persons, and we have worked with them, and to this end, we think that also as a sector, we've been able to consolidate ourselves. Because in South Africa, there's a history where you would have organizations for and organizations off. And that has forced the sector to come up with an organization that would address in a more consolidated fashion, issues of disability, because disability is a complex issue. To date, we have what we call the South African Disability Alliance, which is constituted by about 13 organizations. And Disabled People South Africa is an organization which has been driving, you know, that process. In South Africa, we have been quite, I think, fortunate by learning from countries like Zimbabwe in terms of how we need to position ourselves. And to this end, we've worked with this government in terms of looking at how you would integrate disability. And we have opted to looking at integrating disability or mainstreaming disability within across legislation and policy. There is, however, a debate around that, but the key issue is that we have moved away from a medical model to a social model, and that we seek to mainstream or integrate disability or disabled people. In our working with the OSDP, we have looked at the INDS, and there's a process of reviewing that policy document, and that's